When you live in a poor neighborhood, you're living in an area where you have to have poor schools. When you have poor schools, you have poor teachers. When you have poor teachers, you get a poor education. And when you get a poor education, you are destined to be a poor man and a poor woman the rest of your life.
Welcome to episode two of To Ed With Love, the podcast.
We back. We got your co-host, Larry Irvin, a.k.a. Bam, a.k.a. Big Bam, Nola Boy, proud Delgado graduate, proud LSU graduate. We here. What's going on? My co-host.
Christina Jones, a.k.a. iPad Chief Problem Solver, IPZ. All those wonderful nicknames that I've been given over the years.
Absolutely. What's going on, man? What's going on with you? How you feeling?
Man, it's been a long day. What a good day, you know.
Yeah. Working in ed reform.
Working in ed reform in New Orleans. Sometimes you get a little tiny chin check and, you know, you keep it moving, right?
Yeah, we got chins though, right?
We got chins.
Skin in the game.
Yes, we do.
We have resiliency.
Yeah, all of those wonderful
superlatives. Absolutely.
Right?
Let's check in, man. What's going on right now in news, man? What's caught your attention, man? IPZ.
Two things. What's going on in the White House, my dude?
Talk to us.
You know, we knew over the weekend, this is like West Wing on steroids, man. I almost feel like the whole world lives in D.C. right now, because when I lived in D.C., this is the kind of stuff that was like the soap opera of the day, right? Mm. This is like a global soap opera. So we know that special prosecutor Robert Mueller has brought some charges against some folks for conspiracy and fraud and trying to throw our presidential election via our friends in Russia. And the White House is scrambling. And for once, our president is almost silent on Twitter.
That's a good thing.
Right. So, yeah. So, you know,
get off folks, of Twitter.
Some folks are thinking that this may be a building a case to impeach him. Others are saying that maybe it will affect the entire cabinet of the White House. Probably both are a little hyperbole.
Yeah, but we've been hearing the impeach narrative for some time, I think. But do we really want Pence?
No, but you know, if it goes as deep as some people say, he might have to go too.
He might have to go also.
Right. So, and I know people are like, oh, it's taking a long time. But it's only been 284 days that the man has been president, and we are already got special prosecutors prosecuting people about election fraud, right? Who are pretty close to him. And it took more than a year to impeach Nixon. And so, you know. I know we are an excited generation of folks who want it yesterday. We got Twitter and Facebook and ready access, but let's just see how this one plays out.
Yeah, this is the story that keeps on, the gift that keeps on giving.
Plenty
the saga continues
of coffee table talk right here.
Yeah, Trump definitely keeps the conversation lively. That's for sure, man. You know, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's in communities or in barbershops, man, I've never seen, as much as he's cutting up, I've never seen so many people involved and engaged in conversation, presidential politics, national politics, local politics, hopefully a little bit more. But what else going on out there, man? I'm we're hearing about this prison release, this 1900 coming home, you know, which is a huge deal. I think they're calling this thing the first 72, if I stand corrected. What you think about that, man? I think we that's a conversation that definitely needs to be had more in the community, man. And what we do about transitioning some of our guys, man. We all got that cousin, that sibling,
that brother,
that uncle, who may have did a little juice, if I use a little bit of New Orleans slang. And they got to come home. And I think it's crucial that we really consider how we embrace these cats. Men and women, as they come home, man, from doing their bids, man. And, you know, what does that look like from a community standpoint? And are we really giving these brothers a real chance to transition back into society, man, from an employment standpoint, a welfare standpoint, economic standpoint? That's what's going on with us right now, man. So we just wanted to check in right quick. What you listening to right now, Chris? What's in the iPhone? What's in the radio play right now? I can tell you what I'm waiting on.
So, I just want to make one comment about the 1900 coming home. I think this is an opportunity for community to like really push the envelope on how we collectively welcome them home, because we know a lot of those cats are going to come back to New Orleans. I think our esteemed producer told us the number somewhere around 400. Yeah, a little over 400. That's a lot of folks. When I lived in New York, their number was that in Harlem, in West Harlem, that most of the folks who got locked up in the state of New York and coming back to the city were coming back to that zip code. So it's really important that we not just talk about it, but figure out how we can be useful and helpful, because we want them to stay home. This is their opportunity to come out. Some of them might have never come out. So let's make it the best for them.
Right.
Now back to your fun question.
And I do apologize.
No, that's
I apologize.
Okay.
My dear friend, my business partner, for moving on and segueing a little bit too fast, not giving you a chance to chime in on that. But that's a huge issue that we definitely need to continue and perpetuate the dialogue about, man. Because I think those first couple of days of a guy coming home, man, having that experience, man, is really crucial. Because a lot of those cats might be on the fence as far as what direction they want to go, feeling like, you know, they've already checked out and society is giving up on them. And, they're coming on really delicate and sensitive, I think, in regards to, you know, how they're going to be seen and how they're going to be embraced by the community, by their families and friends, man. And if we, you know, I think we've seen it before when they're not fully embraced or they're not given opportunity, what usually happens, you know. So,
Yeah, I mean, we're not foolish. We recognize some folks, they're going to do what they do. They're going to come home. They're going to know one thing. They're going to do that thing because that's the fastest, most expedient and thing you have the most experience doing, maybe, right? But there's some folks who are literally coming home trying to think about things differently or get another opportunity. And 72 hours of disappointment when you're very fragile, I imagine, could break your spirit, especially because it's got to be overwhelming to be in one place with a certain set of rules every day. And then all of a sudden you're out here and there are a whole bunch of different kinds of rules and freedoms, right?
And new technologies.
With freedoms
and
comes
freedoms.
Opportunity costs and, you know, and mistakes, right?
Right.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So, and before we get back to our question about what we're listening to, I did want to say, that locally we have a lot going on, right? You know, we talked about the national situation, but what do we have going on locally, Larry? Like, what's local politics looking like in New Orleans? The whole world is watching it, as a matter of fact.
It looks like the Charbonnet and Cantrell race. That's what it looks like. And, you know, it seems like they're starting to take the gloves off a little bit when it comes to the attacks, the personal attacks and things of that nature, man. And even legal charges. We're at that juncture now where, you know, they're playing hardball.
Coming down
the stretch with this thing, man. So I think we're all excited to see what's going to happen. Both parties are strong. You know, the community is pretty split as far as, you know, whether, you know, where they're putting their bets and where they're putting their money. It's a good, lively conversation. You know, we've had some work with LaToya in the past. She's been an advocate and things of that nature. So, you know, we'll see what happens, man. I just, you know, my whole take on politics, you know, since the beginning, man, is just when I see it go this route, when it becomes about personal attacks and not so much about the skill sets, the dispositions that people are bringing to the table, I kind of check out, man. I kind of check out because that's not really what I'm tuning in for, is to see personal attacks on people. I'm tuning in to see how we can push the envelope and move forward together as a community, as one man, and put everybody in the best position to have a quality of life, man. So you're tuning in. This is Brothers in Power to Teach, the second show. Your co-host Larry Irvin, a.k.a. Big Bam. And we got IPZ over here. Christina Jones.
Yeah.
A.k.a. iPad. What you listening to, man? Let's segue. What you listening to? Let's talk a little music before we jump into our topic today.
You know, I have been listening to a lot of old school lately. Like, it has been New Jack Swing in the car as of late. Like, the other day I heard it was Puff and Mace, I've Been Around the World. Oh, my God. Beautiful. I love that song. I've Been Around the World. Every time I hear that song, I think about my little brother who looks like Mace. Shout out, Aaron.
Shout out to Dean.
Man. Yeah, man. And I've been, you know, 44s in regular, 444s in regular rotation. Not as regularly as some of Jay's other albums. I mean, I appreciate 444, but I realize that, like, it's not my favorite. I think it's great, right?
Yeah.
But it's not my favorite, right?
Yeah, I think Diddy said that he thought that was Jay's best album. You know me, we always talk to Jay. And Jay's music, man, I think out of his catalog, I think American Gangster definitely is my favorite. You know, the cliche answer is Reasonable Doubt, but I think you take a look at what Jay did with American Gangster, man, how he was able to kind of encapsulate that space in that time, film, man. Being so removed from that experience and his narrative. I can't put it into words what that means to listen to that album and how fresh it sounds. It sounds almost as if Jay was still
in the 70s.
Yeah, he was still
in Harlem on 129th. Like that, you know?
Right there, you know.
Right.
Right there in the middle of it, man. So, but 444 is one I can't stop listening to. I think it's debatable. I definitely think it's debatable as far as my personal opinion and taste. Mm-hmm. As far as if you want to contrast and compare it to American Gangster or even A Reasonable Doubt, you definitely got some people that say the Black Album stands out as some bangers.
The Black Album's not one of my favorites either.
Yeah. I mean, I guess
there's some definite bangers on the Black Album, but overall, it's not my favorite. I really do like 444. I think it's a great album. I think Jay is a teacher, right? Kind of like, you know, kind of like, is it mom? Somebody in his life was a teacher. You know, and I always think about that line that he says about, you know, you said I wouldn't be anything. A teacher said I wouldn't be anything. Right. You know what I mean? And, you know, now look at him. So I appreciate that about him. And I think that it's really powerful that he uses this album to sort of reflect on the things men learn about being men. And how it negatively affects everything in their negatively affect everything in their life if it's toxic, right? Yeah. Like, you know. Yeah. So I think I appreciate that because I think it's a conversation that certainly needs to be had and addressed and recognized.
Yeah.
And I definitely don't necessarily agree with some folks who feel like, you know, there's some lady or somebody wrote a blog about the this album and it's being an apology to Beyonce and sort of being this like big. You know how they say like men, they're men who are wife beaters and they beat their wife and then they're so apologetic and they take them to Paris and they like, you know, they do some big grand gesture about how jacked up it is.
Yeah.
This lady was kind of saying this about that. And I was like, no, I don't think that at all. I mean, he's completely vulnerable and that takes a lot of courage. Yeah. And I think it encourages men to be vulnerable because vulnerability is freedom in many ways.
Yeah. Right? I mean, but this is just, I think just to look at it in such a closed scope. Any project that Jay does, we do understand how, you know, the Beyonce situation is relevant, but Jay's works are so layered as far as messages, and it takes, if you truly give his album a real listen, which I like to call it, it takes some time.
Or take the lens off and just open your ears and listen, right? Like, he is the fact that he opens these conversations with other brothers through his videos, right? Where they're talking too about how they know their things that they learned in the street or from other men about, you know, growing relationships, being fathers, et cetera, that they now see in retrospect were toxic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like what that means and how they've lost friendships or relationships or whatever over that. And, you know, I think we could segue that into just talking a little bit about, you know, this podcast, right?
Yeah, we could probably do a whole podcast on 444, but let's definitely segue. But before we segue though, I'm waiting on this Freddie versus Jason, Jada Kiss, and Fabulous collaboration, and I think it's gonna, I is think it this coming? Project It's coming. It was like on Angie Martinez. Coming. It's coming. It's official.
Okay.
It's official. All right. I've been waiting for a year. A little bit over a year, I think.
I keep Googling it.
But I think this Freddie versus Jason, I hope, just puts, and I think we're seeing lyrics come back to the forefront
as far as rapping. Well, thank goodness for that. I appreciate that. And so you know, if you don't know anything about me and Larry, you've probably figured out by now that we love hip hop. So that's true. But anyway, back to how these conversations kind of tie into the work we do. So, you know, one of our values is what? Remain relevant.
Remain relevant.
Right? So how we remain relevant? We keep up with what's going on around us.
Yeah.
Culturally, yeah. Music-wise, politics-wise.
Yeah.
You know, with fashion.
Yes.
we do believe in a good fashion situation.
Absolutely. Just because you work in education don't mean you can't be fly. Let's just, for the record, whoever's listening out there, it don't mean you can't be fly, but go ahead.
So. Right. If we're going to brag, we'll say we do that pretty well.
We do. We do look good. We look good doing this work.
Yeah, we do.
What are we talking about today? Let's jump into it.
So we're going to transition into talking about what we're talking about today. So, you know, it's back to school, back to reality.
Back to school, back to reality.
We've been back in school now for a couple of months. We just come off fall break, and we're skirting right into the holiday season. So what we want to spend time talking about today was sort of, you know, this new school year and what we have seen so far, and some things we want folks to give you and feed your mind and have you think about, and like get at us and tell us, you know, what you think about these things. So you can reach us at brothersteach@be2t.org if you want to send us an email. You can also reach us at #realbrusteach. That's also our Twitter handle and the gram.
Yes, ma'am.
And I do believe we have a Snapchat page. But this is when I'll just tell you that my age does not allow Snapchat to compute. So you can find us or search for us or something on Snapchat, I'm sure. Next time we're here, we'll know what our snap is.
Tentatively, right? We have a snap. Yeah. If we know our snap.
We definitely have a snap, because those fellows, they be snapping it up.
Yeah, snapping and filtering and dog earring or whatever they do with it. So, what's going on right now? Back to school, back to reality, our second show feels good. And what we talking? I mean, do you want to just set the aggregate context as far as what we're saying at Reform and NOLA? There's a lot going on. There's a lot of conversations, a lot of sub dialogues about the reunification of OPSB, Orleans Parish School Board, and the Recovery School District. And what are some of the implications of that and ramifications of that, and what's that going to look like, and how do we, get a more centralized system to where everybody is getting a fair shot at this education thing, man. Because we definitely seen, there are some pros, but we definitely seen some cons that affected our students in a way that just makes the educational experience look more daunting every day, if you will, man. There's a lot of layers to this conversation. We could talk Bessie, we could talk ESSA, we can talk transportation issues, we can talk budgets, we can talk MFP dollars.
And don't worry, we will also tell you what all these acronyms mean. Because I'm sure you hear them out in these streets and are like, what exactly
does that mean? Yeah, right? So that's what we're here for. That's definitely what we're here for. Right. That's to simplify the conversation, right. I guess, for a lot of people out there that's concerned about what's going on in education, man. And we'll do our best attempt to try to simplify it so you can follow along in this conversation. No matter what your acumen is in regards to the education conversation, man. So Let's jump in, man. Set the stage. What's going on right now?
Just one more thing. We want you to reckon. We hope you hear us and want to participate actively with us. And this is not us preaching to the choir and just ed folks. We want everybody. Like, we need to hear your voices. We need to collectively work together to do some things that we hope to achieve here. Now on to your question about what's up. You know, the saying I think I've heard a few times is, as New Orleans goes, so goes the world. I've heard this before. And so, we talk a lot about New Orleans because New Orleans is home, right?
Yeah.
But all eyes have been on New Orleans for a while post-Katrina about our public education
situation.
Let's
call it a situation.
Yes. I like that. It's a situation. Right. So, you know, if you're listening and you're outside of New Orleans and you want to know what's up in New Orleans, here's what's up.
from the ground.
Right. Post-Katrina, some decisions were made legislatively to reform the New Orleans public school system by placing it in a legal format called the Recovery School District, which is generally created for failing or struggling schools to go and sort of be revitalized and come back out to their district ready to roll, right?
Right.
Post-Katrina, the storm, some of the challenges that public schools had in New Orleans before the storm, a lot of under-resourced, like money-wise schools, a lot of the infrastructures that were falling apart, et cetera. The state and legislature decided that these schools should be put in the Recovery School District, and everyone should just sort of be restart, like press the restart button. New teachers, new everything, right?
Right.
And we have suffered some of the opportunity costs of doing it that way ever since.
Right.
Would you say that's fair to say?
That's definitely fair to say. I think it's something we see all the time. You know what I mean? So, but I think for the listeners out there who may not have all the context, I guess how we got to Act 91 is key, or what Act 91 is.
Okay.
Key.
So let's fast forward and get there.
We can fast forward, or do you want to set a context as far as maybe what OPSB, Orleans Parish School Board, what it looked like, and what we heard, what we hear from people that we work with,
mm-hmm.
who were there, your doctor, Darius, Dr. Lisa's, and people that, you know, proud 35 graduates and things of that nature, and proud Kennedy graduates, and what did New Orleans schools, public school system look like prior to Katrina, and why did people feel like it was so critical to flip the system on its head post Katrina? Why was there so much opportunity? Why was there so much change in regards to the education system, and RSD, the inception of RSD? What was going on? I mean,
well, you know, prior
the narrative anyway. I think the narrative
prior know. To the belief is wholeheartedly that prior to the storm, the schools were an abject failure. To be put it bluntly, right?
Right.
But we know that's not true because we see tons of different folks of color and white folks who've been to public schools in New Orleans prior to the storm, who are doing big things. They are judges. They are they're civil district judges. They're district attorneys. They are running their own law firms. They're doing all these things. They've gone on to universities like Southern University, which, by the way, graduates the highest number of black attorneys in the state of Louisiana, right?
Shout out to SU.
Right? Shout out to Southern. And so there's this misnomer that everything was so broken that it could not be fixed, when the truth is New Orleans probably had some of the same problems that other urban districts have as people move away and your tax base shrinks and you have to figure out how to use your resources more efficiently, right? So there's no doubt that there were some definite difficult challenges that the New Orleans Parish School Board faced prior to the storm.
Of course.
We know that there were some administrative things that they didn't do as well as they could.
Of course.
Whatever, right? But every major organization has issues. And those issues definitely needed to be addressed. So post the storm, what we got, the idea of choice, we've got for the first all charter district in the nation, and how we got there was through Act 91, which was the transfer of Orleans schools back to Orleans local control. And it was the end of Recovery School District sort of managing on behalf of Orleans, their public schools. And the only way we could get to that Act 91 transfer was to agree that the remaining five schools in New Orleans would become charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're the first national charter. Now we're the first district to have all charter
completely,
schools.
100%.
And so, nationally, people are looking at us as a potential model for choice. And so this is the first semester of that transfer. It happened in July, right?
Right. I guess there's a lot to unfold in this conversation,
man. There's a lot to unfold, yeah.
And this is a conversation that we kind of have all the time. We're in the work on a daily basis, and we see sort of the multi-layered issues that, you know, I guess the charter system can bring to communities, how it makes it very difficult from a transportation system sometimes for kids to get to school. We've seen alongside with Act 91 or the some of the things that took place post-Katrina, we saw mass exodus of veteran teachers. I think about 700, between 750 and 800, if my number serves me right, veteran teachers.
More like, it was in the, I think it
was, we saw a lot of teachers.
High number. It was like 10,000 or something that got fired from the district. It was a lot of teachers.
Was it that high?
Was it not that high?
It's 700. It's 700. 700.
700. 7,500 teachers and faculty.
7,500.
7,500 staff.
Okay.
7,500 staff, including administration, educators, coaches.
A lot of them being teachers.
A lot of them.
Most of them being teachers. A mass exodus. Excuse us for, yeah, we stand correct. Excuse us for those.
Thank you.
Those stats, those skewed stats. So around 7,500 teachers. And I think if you just talk from that aspect and what that means and what that does to community and to tradition and to culture, you're pretty much starting a culture over in some instances when you pull.
Yeah, and you're basically signaling that all the culture is not good, right? None of it.
Yeah, I mean,
let's just say that that's left a bad taste in many people's mouths locally.
Right.
You know, let's set the stage, though. New Orleans is, I think New Orleans definitely has one of the highest percentage of places where students are enrolled in private school. So, you know, private school has been the way to go in New Orleans for a long time. Just from perception alone, right? But I think that there's still opportunity here, even in this charter school thing.
Yeah.
Because we can't go backwards, right? We've made these choices.
Yeah, we can't go back. I think the only thing we can do now is to figure out the solutions. You know, how does our RSD, Recovery School District, and OPSB, coexist as one and move forward in a positive way, man?
RSD is kind of stepping off. They're transferring all their property things back to Orleans Parish Schools.
Right.
They'll have to finish out building the new schools that they contracted to do.
I see them more as property managers anyway.
Right.
As far as, you know, their power with the facilities and shutting schools down. I mean, they have a very specific, I guess, role in the process. But I think a lot of people get it confused in regards to RSD and what exactly they do.
Right, because it's really the Department of Education that makes all the curriculum decisions and all that good stuff.
That's some of the clarity. Right. Back to the teaching thing, though, man, and I know we can probably unfold that situation and that just from that scope, we can probably do a whole show on the effect and what we see on the ground. I think it's very ironic that we have such a need for educators, but we have such a mass exodus of educators post-Katrina. And I know you like to refer to it as social engineering in some regards, allegedly social engineering. But I guess how do we fold that gap? Or how do we, I guess, allow, if they want to, if they feel, you know, if they, depending on what their disposition is at this point, how do we allow, I guess, some of those educators to come back into the system? Would they be embraced and I guess, address this huge gap and this huge need that we have for not only black educators, but just educators in general in Orleans Parish?
Well, I mean, I think post reunification, we still have the same issues we had prior to unification, which is we have low morale, we have high turnover, and we have we have at least some turnover every year of a school, right, to some degree, whether it be the charter management organization or be a school closing. And so I think that all of this prior to now has led to a lot of instability. And I think the big opportunity we have now with unification and local control is to create some stability with things we've known for a long time are a challenge, and human talent capital is one of those, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is there some sort of way that we have a returning veteran teachers hiring effort? Do we market ourselves to, you know what I mean? Do we invite them to some sort of new school boot camp to acclimate them with charter schools and the way charters work. I don't know. But, you right. know, we know all the time that we see teachers, veteran teachers are seen as ones that yesterday at the U-Lead thing for Urban League, Session 5, shout out U-Lead, the teachers were talking about how they've been in the school 4 years and they're the vet, you know?
Yeah.
I had one teacher who's like been teaching for 6 years, but she's been to like 3 or 4 schools, right?
Yeah. We definitely see a high turnover in regards to teachers in this new system.
And sort of, you know, and we hear all the time that the two things that keep them from wanting to stay is they feel disrespected, you know? Yeah. Like, I mean, I made the point yesterday that like, we know all these nonprofits where people working and they are busting their hump, right? And they're not getting paid that much, but they stay for a long time. They be at a nonprofit for 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 8 years,
right?
They move around. They, you know, shout out Emily Wolf. She went from a Vista Corps member to ED at Broadmoor. You know what I mean? Like, we know people who stay, and they're not getting paid, right?
Right. So shout out to Emily, my Kellogg fellow. I think that's how you say it, right? WKKF, Kellogg Leadership Fellow. She definitely did a lot of good work, man, and set a good foundation in Broadmoor. But I'm sorry, go
right? Ahead. Yeah. And so what is it that keeps teachers from wanting to stay when they're kind of making in similar ways similar salaries? By the way, they're on a 9-month contract, so we're not really doing a good job of selling teaching because 9 months at $46,000 is pretty good money. When you're a first year coming out of college, right?
Right.
I think we have to tell a different story. Now that we have local control about how we get teachers in the classroom, right? We have to tell a different narrative.
Right.
We have to sell it to them about why it's important. We have to make it cool. That's what we're trying to do. We have to make people connected. And we got to stop telling the narrative around teaching is the kids are bad and the money is terrible, right?
Yeah.
And then on addition to that, you got parents telling their kids who want to teach, don't you do that. That's a terrible thing. Like it's the career of last resort. You know?
Yeah, I think, you know, with there's a lot of different elements and moving pieces to this conversation. Like we said before, we named off a bunch of acronyms and things of that nature as far as I guess some of the cons that we've seen as far as the charter system and post Katrina ed reform in New Orleans. And there's definitely a narrative. We've been in a lot of national conversations and national convenings and different groups, educational groups and community groups have come to New Orleans and we've been on a myriad of panels, locally, regionally, across the country. And, I think the consensus is outside New Orleans, the consensus, outside Louisiana, the consensus, is that we haven't figured out. We have this charter system figured out, like you said, right now New Orleans is sort of seen as the flagship, or the best representation of the model to follow in regards to implementing the charter school system into communities, man. But we definitely see some different things on the ground or counter narrative on the ground in some regards. I guess we can, you know, just to balance the conversation off some, Chris, let's talk about some of the positives. If there are few, if there are many, let's talk about some of the positives. I know for sure, I guess we can, as far as the graduation rates, we always hear graduation rates and college enrollment, right? And we know a lot of times these numbers can be skewed. We know the numbers from a data standpoint always kind of get finagled to put forth a certain narrative. There's a lot of people invested, a lot of money invested, a lot of names on the line in regards to the system and ensuring that it works. And making it look like it's working. Are there some true wins, I guess, that we're seeing on the ground as far as the system?
I mean, I think the win is always local control, right? Like, it's a win even if it was a compromise and it had to be the remaining five. I mean, there's already over 80. So, you know, and they were kind of already chartered because they were just under the Orleans Parish School Board's ownership, right, or management. So right. I think that's a win. I think it's a win if people choose to be as actively engaged and thoughtful about participating in what's happening in schools now that they're locally controlled, as we are about the presidential election.
Right.
I think that's a win. I think it's a win that all of us are talking about Ed right now. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think it's also a win that at least one of our mayoral candidates has talked about education, participated in the education debate, and cares about it, because we haven't really had any. The mayors have largely stayed out of this debate for the most part, right? They really have kind of been agnostic, not really said anything.
Yeah, I mean,
and,
that's...
We
always ask that question, why?
Right.
Why are more of these candidates
right.
pushing the education conversation to the top of the...
Right.
To the top of the docket.
Right. We just talked about 1,900 people getting released from prison and 400 of them come back, at least 400 of them come back to New Orleans. Education has something to do with probably a good percentage of those young men and women's trajectory toward ending up in jail. You right. know what I mean?
Right.
Because we know high school dropouts have like a 75% chance, if they're low income, of ending up in jail. Right?
Right.
You know what I mean? That's pretty ridiculous. So I think that's good to see. And I think teachers are starting to ask themselves, like, we are the labor in this building. How do we get some of the things we need or desire, right?
Right.
Because the truth is, they will walk. The millennial teachers will walk on you, right?
They're not standing for it. They're not standing right. for the games, for the non-structure.
Or the too much structure.
They want freedom. And we're talking from for our listeners out there, we're talking about, you know, prospective educators and incumbent educators of a certain age demographic. The new recent graduate, they want impact. They want their hands on. They want to impact curriculum. They want to bring themselves, their own dispositions and characters, to their classrooms. They want the freedom to do that, to be creative. We were just having a conversation with a potential school partner today. Should we keep her anonymous?
Right.
For now, until that contract gets signed. But we were just so refreshed to hear her right. perspective of
art and science. Yep.
Right. The human element, it seems, has been taken out of education in this new space that we're working in. Teachers want to be involved, man, and it seems so many times we see these cookie cutter approaches from these new systems, these new charter systems, man. And it's so teachers are a lot of times very confused. We understand how much data predicates your tenure and your longevity. And a lot of times the data has to be turned around really quick. It has to show really quick. That's a lot of pressure. You know, we understand what the tests mean, the standardized tests mean, and Common Core, and some of these systems are supposed to make the lives of teachers better. But we're hearing a counter narrative to things like that. I wanted to touch on real quick and get your perspective on this whole narrative around access. Parents having more, communities, people having more choice, people having more access. There's this narrative around this charter system that, you know, or this belief, ideally, that, you know, people have full choice when it comes to where they want to send their kids to school. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw one app make a valiant attempt at that. But we also know at the same time with independent control with some of these CMOs that open enrollment isn't necessarily open enrollment. And we kind of see that out of time. That's defined different. A little differently, depending on the school campus you're referring to, in regard to this open access, open enrollment thing. Touch a little bit on that for us, Chris, if you will, and what you've seen from, you sat on school boards, I've sat on the school board. We've kind of seen from both vantage points, as entrepreneurs and also kind of inside the storm, in the eye of the storm, what that can look like.
Well, I would say that the one challenge I think that we see is that in order to really have community engagement, you got to really be willing to deal with the community's bringing, right? And what the parents are bringing. And everybody's not bringing what you are used to, want to deal with, have the capacity or knowledge to handle, right? And so I think we see too often that parents, and I heard this last night while I was at ULEAD, that parents too often feel like schools are not places for them, right? They're not welcoming places. They're not looking for parents to be, you know, to come through the door, and that they sort of feel like they're on the outside. Also heard from some community members that they felt like these schools need to be coming to the community and not the community coming to them. And I think that that's pretty accurate. You're asking people to entrust their children in a system that they're not quite, that's not that easy to navigate, honestly. There's so many choices.
So many choices,
you know, and some of them look almost the same. And we know from my class at University of New Orleans that did this project when I was leading them with Marla Nelson, that a lot of children are being bused a mile from a school that's close to them that's as bad or worse than the school they're being bused to. Right?
Yeah.
So we also got this system where we're busing children to schools that aren't that great away from home where parents can't really interact. So I think we have the challenge of figuring out how we help parents interact with their schools when they're all over the place.
Yeah. Parent engagement is a huge issue.
But we also know that we hear schools say they're not really that interested in that. What they need you to do is let them do their job.
Yeah.
And you stay home, right?
Yeah.
And so there's some balance between that. And I get that we hear frequently that this generation of parents, younger parents, don't do necessarily like our parents did. If a teacher called home, the thing was, what'd you do? Why is your teacher calling me?
Right?
You must have done something, right?
Culturally, a lot of things have changed.
Right? Because we recognize that a lot of times kids are just doing stupid stuff. Right. You know what I mean? They're just being kids, right? And they're not paying attention. They're being rambunctious. And so our parents handled it differently. Now we see the flip side of that, which is a lot of parents come first with the defense of the child, second with what you do to my kid, right?
Right.
But we have, I think some of us in how we manage schools has fostered that, you know, because those parents probably had that experience while they were at school.
Right. I think you see a lot of, and we walk through hallways a lot doing school observations and things of that nature and have these conversations about parent engagement and access. And I think from my vantage point, I see the conversation is about control. There's a disconnect between whether it's staffers, whether it's educators in the classroom. Figuring out, I think, from a cultural standpoint, how to deal with New Orleans kids, and culturally, New Orleans is a unique place. We know that, and connection is big. Connection is big here. Familiarity is big here. When you're unfamiliar, we don't recognize you. That's that. And I think it's just our teachers are afraid, or I guess the new breed. And there's a bunch of narratives out there, but from what we're seeing, and we're gonna keep it real talk, right? Or the new wave of educators, the young recent graduate from let's call her Kelly from Minnesota, she went to Columbia, 25 years old, 4.0, journalism major, content strong, King's English. Never been in New Orleans. Minimal to no contact with the black community. We see this all the time. When you got TD coming in there asking about little Kevin, sometimes it can be a bridge, that can be a gap, I think, in communication, to say the least. There's a gap in experience, there's a gap in connection, there's a gap that we're seeing. And I just think, I mean, that's a microcosm that hypothetical situation, but that's a microcosm kind of what we're seeing in classroom. I think it comes down to control. From a disciplinary standpoint, a lot of these teachers, these recent graduates, just don't understand culturally, behaviorally. Trauma is a conversation we're going to talk about frequently. There's a lot of things that go into a New Orleans classroom, I think, just in general, and what you need to be prepared to do and deal with. And I think it's almost unfair for these teachers to be thrown in these situations and not have the training and the conversations. And a lot of time you see the lack of parent engagement. You see the lack of student engagement because there's just not a connect. We're going to break for a second. I guess we'll start back off with that parent engagement piece. To Ed with Love, your co-host, Larry Irvin, CEO, Brothers in Power to Teach, my beautiful co-host, Christina Jones.
iPad.
Thank y'all for tuning in. We'll be right back at you. We back. It's your co-host, Larry Irvin, a.k.a. Bam, a.k.a. Big Bam to you. To Air With Love podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for staying tuned in. We'll continue the conversation with my co-host, Christina Jones. Talking reunification, talking Article 91, talking New Orleans education, ed reform. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We left off on the parent engagement piece, Christine, and some of the disconnect that we see in that regard, in regards to cultural connection that we see. And just from an overall standpoint, want to give you an opportunity to kind of touch on parent engagement or the lack thereof that we're seeing, some of the implications of that, and why we're seeing that in this new charter system that we're moving about. And I think for good measure, we should, give people that context or define for those out there who don't know exactly, because we use a lot of acronyms, right? We use a lot of acronyms, abbreviations. Let's define, as you address, if you can, if you will, the parent engagement piece. What exactly is a charter school for those who hear the term all the time, but may not know exactly what's going on when they hear that term?
So first of all, let's just say, we come from the New Orleans lens a lot, and but we know from traveling nationally that what we see in New Orleans is having a great effect across the country, and we got a lot of similar issues with parent engagement, et cetera, that other urban districts have. I think the challenge here in the environment in New Orleans is the charter school movement makes it so parents have significantly more choice, which also means their kids might not be going to school in the neighborhood, right? Or close by. So we've heard anecdotally so many stories about kids who are living in one part of town, who are bused on the other part of town, who are essentially working factory job hours, getting on the bus at 6 a.m., getting home as late as 7 or 8 p.m., depending on where they go to school. I know I have a neighboring kid. I saw her getting off the bus at like 6:45, and I stopped her and I asked her father, I said, "Where do you go to school?" And she told me across the river. And I was like, wow, you get home so late, and she's in the fourth grade. So those are some of the consequences, the unforeseen consequences, I think, of like choice being so wide, choice meaning that you could go to school in any corner of New Orleans.
Right.
And that challenge is particularly difficult for parents who work hourly jobs. And New Orleans, we know, has the highest, our thing is hospitality and tourism. So you can't be calling off at 2 o'clock to go to a meeting across town.
Right.
And we know that we have a public transportation challenge, a significant one here in New Orleans, and it could take you 2 hours to get, from one part of town to another. So that alone makes the challenge of getting parents engaged difficult. The other thing that makes it difficult is that the schools have to be responsible for providing transportation to kids all over the planet, essentially.
Independently.
And that is a very expensive endeavor. Both of you and I have served on a school board. That $500,000 school board contract we had to sign for transportation was a good chunk of our revenue.
And all schools don't have that.
Right.
Y'all was fortunate to have that money to cut that
and
check.
And schools are not transportation planners, right?
They're not.
Right? They're not logistically transportation planners. And so...
you got schools that don't have buses.
Right. So...
That's real. You actually have schools that don't have buses, and it's on the parents.
Right.
To get that kid to and from school entire year.
And we know what that means. That's sort of a cut, right? That cuts what kind of student is coming to your school, right?
Yeah.
One who has access to easy transportation, one who parents got no trouble getting them there,
right?
We know we heard recently Einstein Charter Schools is suing Orleans Parish School Board about transportation because it is such an expensive endeavor,
mm-hmm.
and because they can't possibly provide transportation the way they would like to in a safe manner that is cost effective. And so this school has said, maybe we should just tell parents, you know, they got to figure it. The school, the bus, you know, the New Orleans bus. I will tell you, I'm from New York, and when I moved to the city, you know, kids in New York do take the subway and the bus, right? We're talking 6th, 7th, 8th grade. They're taking the bus by themselves. They've been taught how to do that. We do know that, you know, New York has some choice, so kids do go to charter schools, but it's still there's still traditional model. Kids still go to school close by. And I think that that is definitely a challenge in parent engagement. I think the other thing is that, you know, we just had our conversation with our studio engineer. Charter schools, people don't really know what they are, right? What does that mean? And we're asking people to navigate and negotiate a system where your kid have three kids and none of them go to the same school, which is cool if you can manage going between those three schools. But it's almost like parents are ignored about what they ask for, right? Because I just heard some parents today making a decision about a charter school because it's opening in their neighborhood. And it's too hard for them to coordinate getting across town to these different schools. And people make it sound like parents don't care about their kids' education. They do, but they also got to consider the logistics, right? And the fact that they got to bring the bread home, right?
Mama got to work. Daddy got to work.
And it's like we ignore the fact that parents are saying, I would really like a school near my house. Right. And so when we're busing all these kids to schools that are worse or, you know, or as bad or worse than the neighborhood school, what are we really doing for parent engagement, right? And what are we? How are we really helping parents make decisions about where their kids go? You know, why don't we listen to this stuff about community schools and all this stuff that parents want? And I heard so many parents and teachers say yesterday that some school buildings used to be these living, breathing organisms. Shout out Wilson Elementary School. Used to be open from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Right. Basketball, art, all that stuff.
Right.
You know, those are ways parents get engaged. Right. And parents don't have to be there every day, all day, PTA, everything else. But they need to feel like they know what's going on in the building. If they want to know what's going on with their kid, they can go in there and check. And we have not created that environment, right?
Not at all.
And I think some schools do it better than others. Some schools are really good at engagement and recognize that you're going to cast a wide net and you're going to get back maybe potentially a small pool. But that potential small pool can have a lot of impact inside of a school building, right?
Yeah, man, it's a lot, Chris. It's a lot, iPad. It's a lot we got to deal with. Many layers to this thing. You know, when you're talking about school choice and you know, the charter system and all of the implications that come with that. But I want to take a step back, you know, before we close out and put a bow on this conversation and just give a very primitive, very simple definition, or even give an analogy. You know, I love using my sports analogies. Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, I want everybody please email us, contact us, or you can call in. I don't know if we had that option or we still new, bear with us. But we want everybody to have an understanding as far as just the general context of the conversation. And, just have an inclination as far as some of these terms that we're using. Charter school, Christine, and I want you to take a stab at it, but I'm going to give my analogy of kind of how I see it. For my sports people out there, a charter school is essentially, let's say you had a basketball roster, an NBA basketball roster, and we all know everybody gets paid different salaries based on their talent, right? LeBron doesn't get the same money that, you know, a Kyle Korver is going to get. You know, if you follow the Cavs, go Cavs. We gotta clean it up. You know, let's say your plan, right? Let's say a charter school is essentially, you know, each individual player has his own coach, and his playing time is pretty much based on his salary. Let's put it that way. So. And we know salaries range. And I guess to give a greater context and the flip side of it, you know, public school is how you see traditional teams constructed. You have 10 to 12 players, 12 to 15 players. You have one coach, one voice, one central mission to win a championship. Everybody's playing a chord. Charter schools essentially break that up and give everybody their individual platform to kind of move about how they want to. And I would just ask kind of to bring, you know, bring that analogy to a close. Just imagine what type of chemistry you would have if you tried to put a team of 10 or 12 people together and they had their own individual coaches and their playing time was based on their salary, or the success of their play on the court was based on their salary and how much they had to expend as far as personal training and things of that nature. It would be an unfair, it would be an uneven playing field, essentially. And public schools is, you know, a collective. It's a centralized mission, a centralized operation. That's my best way to break it down. I don't know if that was the best analogy, but I like using sports analogies, and that was mine. If people, for my people out there listening who don't really understand, I guess the elements and the functions of a charter school. Chris, am I in the ballpark, roughly?
Yeah, I think you're in the ballpark. I think you could also say it's kind of like the NFL. You got 32 franchises. Each franchise reports to the main office, but they all have their own culture, their own way of
doing business.
Right. They have some standardization based on what the NFL and the NFL Players Association requires.
Right.
But they do things differently, and each one of them functions independently.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a much better sports analogy, I think, than the one I attempted. So, but that's charter schools. You know, it's the fragmentation, if you will.
Decentralization is a nicer way to put it.
Decentralization, excuse my enunciation out there. Decentralization of a system, you know, when and everybody's now independent, and their fates are in their own hands, if you will. And that's from A to Z. That's budgets, that's student enrollment, that's the criteria, that's transportation, that's leadership, that's staffing, that's teachers, teacher recruitment. Everybody's fending for their own in the charter system. And I think there's some good. But we're seeing really more so some of the cons on a daily basis. And that's what this conversation is about. What's a win, Christina? What's a win right now for New Orleans education post-Katrina, the reunification, the space we're moving in? What's a win for us right now moving forward?
So, you know, I'm a East Coast girl with a Midwest reality. And so the Midwestern girls in me says, the win is figuring out how to offer some of these shared services for a system that is decentralized to make the lives of charter school leaders and charter management organizations a little easier as they try to maintain some autonomy. I think transportation is one thing that collectively the negotiation could benefit everyone if central office went back to sort of coordinating that or working with schools to help them plan their transportation and somehow subsidize it, whatever needs to happen, because it's so expensive, or whether there are neighboring charter schools that can share bus services. Like, you know, when I was in school, I went to a urban Catholic school for a little while, and because they were so small and so broke, we shared this bus system with three other urban Catholic schools, right? And so that's actually also a way to rebuild community with kids who are going to all these different schools, because they'll be riding the bus together, right? I think the other win, that like it would be great if Orleans Parish had like a central hub where people could apply to be educators or teachers, and people could pull through the bank and say, hey, there's all these folks who applied at Orleans Parish to teach, and I need a para, I need, you know what I mean? So that you could centralize the opportunity to hire, right? I think the other thing is sort of the benefit negotiation, right? If all these schools are chartered and attached as a portfolio, that's what they call it. Orleans has a portfolio of schools rather than a centralized system. Then is there a way to get like shared benefits? You know, like is there a way for healthcare or like dental or, you know, tuition reimbursement that can be offered as a collective?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we know that East Bank Collaborative, shout out East Bank Collaborative, who was helping independent charter schools in New Orleans, which we really don't have any more of. Think about how to share those things. So I think that would be an easy win without ruffling too many feathers. It might make a lot of economic sense for folks. So I think that's a good win. I think the other win is if we can get the voter turnout for anything related to school in New Orleans. I mean, voter turnout in New Orleans is terrible anyway.
Yes.
But voter turnout for the school board election is abysmal. It's like 12% or less, right?
Yeah.
Like parents and teachers and community, these schools are ours. The people who run them work for us. It's like we forget that, right? But if we don't show up, then the 12% make the decision for the 88%. And that's just the truth. That's the math. Math don't lie, right?
That's the way it's going to stay.
You know what I mean?
That's the way it's going to remain.
We either accept our own demise, or like, I want to see this next time, that we turn up and turn out, right? Like, if we got it to 20%, I'd be happy. That's a huge jump. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is.
So we need parents to care and realize that these folks are the ones making decisions about you, and they only listen to the 12% that vote for them, right?
Yeah. I think one for me is simple, man. A lot of times we're seeing these issues and these conversations, students are just, they're not at the top of the list as far as priorities. I just think I want to see students, the student voice, the community voice, at the you know, in the seats at the tables that matter, and decision making as far as implementation of everything, curricula, criteria, when it comes to school choice, just like. Give students the voice back. Listen, can we listen to our students for once and take that voice seriously? And I think if we do that, the chips will fall in line and we'll be going in the right direction, whatever direction that is, man. So the big win for me is just let's start to listen to our students. Chris, we could talk about this all day. We do talk about it all day. It's our work. It's our life.
Right.
We've been fully immersed in it. What we got coming up for the next show, man? What we talking about next for the next podcast? We talking about a little trauma? We talking about a little
effects
of trauma in the classroom?
Shout out to Kelly Harris for the wonderful jewel she dropped on us when she was working with us. And she did we do this thing with two at Brothers in Power to Teach called the Cypher. And so we had a cypher about this idea about trauma and its effects on students. So the next topic is called... You tripping because you traumatized.
We're going to talk a little bit about trauma and some of the behavioral, I think, implications that we see and that we're facing, that teachers are facing in the classroom. I think that kind of loops back to the conversation we were having earlier as far as that disconnect. You know what I mean? A lot of times, and we're seeing more restorative approaches and programs of that nature. Shout out to Troy, man, restorative approaches, our fellow propeller. Accelerator fellow, she's doing great work in that regard, but we're just seeing a lot of we're seeing trauma pop up in a lot of nuanced ways. I think a lot of subtle ways, and I just think as a community, as a school system, we need to figure out you know, for our educators particularly, how we're going to deal with that. What are some of those signs? And we're going to unmask that and unpack that trauma piece a little bit more for our next show, man.
We hope to have some guests, you know, that are experts in this field, like Dr. Lisa Delpit at Southern University, who runs the Masters of Teaching program focused on urban teaching, and Dr. Lisa Green-Derry, who this is her area of study.
Shout out to Dr. Lisa.
So we hope to have some of those folks on.
Ron Eagle.
Right, and we'll be able to get Charles Corbu on here to talk about that part of trauma and its impact on healthy masculinity. So, stay tuned. Check us out once a month, To Ed With Love podcast.
To Ed With Love.
Episode 2. Reach us at Real Bruhs Teach on Twitter and the Gram.
Yeah.
Search us on Snap because we don't know where we're at.
Right.
And you can email us at brothersteach@BE2T.org.
What's our Facebook form right quick, Chris?
Brothers Empowered to Teach Initiative.
It's the co-host Larry Irvin. It was a pleasure. Be loved, be blessed. We out here.
Audi.